Today is Wednesday, April 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up...
For Kim Jong-un, he wants to get economic help from Putin. For Vladimir Putin, he really is just looking to become more relevant.
That's VOA's Bill Gallo on the expectations of the upcoming North Korea-Russia summit tomorrow. Also ahead, Sri Lanka's president asked the national police chief and the defense secretary to resign. And Iran's president says his country must resist U.S. sanctions. It's all on today's International Edition. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has arrived in the far eastern region of Russia for his first meeting with Vladimir Putin, which Kim says is the initial step toward closer ties with Moscow. Wearing a black fedora hat and matching dark overcoat, the smiling Kim was greeted by Russian officials and a military band today in the port city of Vladivostok. The North Korean leader made the short trip to the city via his signature armored green and yellow train. At the Thursday summit, Kim is expected to push Putin for economic aid, specifically relief from international sanctions that remain in place after nuclear talks with the U.S. broke down. VOA's Bill Gallo is covering the summit, and he spoke with me about expectations from the two leaders.
For Kim Jong-un, he wants to get economic help from Putin and relief from the punishing international sanctions that have not been lifted since the talks have stalled. For Vladimir Putin, he really is just looking to become more relevant and to sort of reassert his relevance and inject himself into these nuclear talks with North Korea. But the expectations of anything that will happen is actually quite slim.
How will this be different from the summit with President Trump?
Well, it seems that all of these summits, to a degree, have a bit of a sort of public messaging aspect to them. There has not been a substance, despite the photo opportunities and whatnot. There have been very few agreements that have actually been reached. That's the expectation here. I think it's just sort of hard for Putin to be able to give any help to Kim Jong-un. Number one, because his economy is not doing very well in itself. And number two, North Korea is not a huge priority for Russia at this point.
Is there any significance of the timing of this summit?
Well, I think that a lot of people in the United States are wondering if perhaps Kim Jong-un is looking for Putin to play this role of kind of spoiler, in many places across the world, whether that's Syria or Iran or in many places, Ukraine, Putin seems to relish the opportunity to just sort of mess up U.S. policy goals. So there are a lot of people who are worried that Putin will do that with North Korea. However, again, it's not clear that he's able to do that without U.S. buy-in. I mean, sanctions actually prohibit Russia from having much economic cooperation with North Korea. But then again, Putin also has a lot of the same goals as it relates to North Korea with the U.S. I mean, he supports denuclearization in a sense. I don't think he wants another nuclear-armed country on its border. And also, he's not okay with threats of nuclear war and things like that, of course.
How is the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, how is he traveling to this location?
Well, it seems his favorite mode of transportation, like his father, is his green and yellow armored train. This thing has done a lot of traveling the last year. He takes the thing to China. He took it all the way to Vietnam for the Hanoi summit, and now he's taking it to Vladivostok. It's a big, slow, armored train.
Yeah, I just was wondering if there's any significance or if he's just doing it out of economics of, traveling via train as opposed to an airplane.
Well, the interesting thing is, of course, Kim Jong-un's father, was afraid of flying. I mean, this was well known. And there has been some speculation that perhaps Kim Jong-un is also afraid of flying. However, Kim Jong-un has flown in the past. He flew to Singapore on an Air China jet. And as for this time, why he didn't fly, it's relatively close to Vladivostok, North Korea is. But also, North Korean state television, interestingly today, broadcast images of Kim Jong-un in planes, flying, just perhaps to clear up, any insinuation that perhaps he's afraid of planes. No, he's not. He just did this for convenience with the train to Russia.
That was VOA's Bill Gallo speaking with me from Seoul, South Korea. Well, Sri Lanka President Maithripala Sirisena has asked the National Police Chief and the Defense Secretary to resign after security forces failed to respond to warnings of the Easter bombings that have killed 359 people. Sirisena's office announced the call for the resignations of the Defense Secretary and Police Chief yesterday. The announcement came one day after Sirisena vowed in a nationally televised address he would take stern action within the next day against officials who failed to inform him about intelligence received that such an attack was imminent. It was not immediately clear who would replace them. Reports say Indian Intelligence Agency sent out several warnings to Sri Lanka and that Indian security agencies had gathered details about Islamic militant group National Tawhid Jamaat, which is suspected of carrying out the attacks. The government also faces scrutiny on whether bitter political wrangling between President Sirisena and his prime minister contributed to the failure to act upon warnings about the attacks. The prime minister acknowledged Tuesday that there had been a breakdown in communication, but said any differences with Sirisena have been resolved. Asked if there are currently active threats in the country, Wickremesinghe said there are still people on the run with explosives. Among the top stories in the world, Russian President Vladimir Putin signs a decree simplifying the procedure for people living in parts of eastern Ukraine held by Russia-backed separatists to obtain Russian citizenship. Vietnam this week celebrates nearly a millennium of independence from China. And U.S. President Donald Trump met yesterday with the top executive of Twitter just 2 hours after complaining the social media platform treats him unfairly. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani says his country must resist U.S. sanctions because the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump does not intend to negotiate in good faith with the Islamic Republic. In his first remarks since the U.S. tightened oil sanctions against Iran earlier this week, Rouhani said today the U.S. is not ready to hold negotiations at all, and its measures are aimed at breaking up the Iranian nation. Rouhani went on to say Iran will have to make the U.S. regret its decision, for which we have no choice but to resist, he says. The Trump administration announced yesterday a May 2nd end to sanctions waivers that allowed some countries to import Iranian oil. The U.S. has further escalated pressure on Tehran by declaring Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps a terrorist group. China also opposes U.S. imposition of unilateral sanctions and long-arm jurisdiction. VOA's Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Jonas Nam, assistant professor of energy, resources, and environment at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, about how this latest move will affect Iran's biggest oil customer, China.
There's sort of a short-term and a long-term problem here, right? And the short-term problem is to try to satisfy the Trump administration's demands that are just incredibly abrupt and are asking them to make significant changes in a time frame that's going to make it very difficult for any of these countries to really shift their oil supply. In the long run, of course, there are ambitious renewable energy programs, ambitious programs to shift away from fossil fuels more broadly that are ongoing in many parts of the world. And so that may, in the long run, relax oil markets globally, but it's not something that will really change things by the end of the year or even maybe by, you know, the end of the decade.
Did this catch the world by surprise, do you think?
I think when the moratorium was released last year, there was sort of an expectation that this would probably continue for a longer time. I think there's been an unusual obsession with Iran in the Trump administration that's catching many analysts by surprise. And so the sort of intensity with which the Trump administration is taking this issue on, I think, has surprised many, has certainly defied expectations.
So what do you suppose might happen? How much does China rely on Iranian oil?
Iranian oil is about 6% of China's domestic consumption.
It's still Iran's biggest market, is that correct?
Yes.
Now, China has been moving forward, as we understand it, in the field of sustainable energy. Is that enough to offset at least some of the loss of the whatever Iranian oil they're taking?
It's unlikely to offset that in the next 2 weeks. And so I think it's really the time frame here that's making it difficult. We also have, you know, already trouble in Venezuela. Libya is not producing. So oil markets are tight, and Iran now dropping out of the picture is making it more difficult to shift to other sources.
Is this going to have, do you think, an effect on the ongoing trade talks? How much is this going to hurt China?
I could see that the Trump administration might anticipate that they can use the trade talks to pressure China into using other sources, but I can also see China maybe reducing its imports from Iran, but actually continuing to import and defying the U.S. in this situation. I think China is certainly going to try to separate the trade conversation from the oil conversation in this current situation.
How important is oil to the Chinese economy?
China's been importing oil, so its domestic production was insufficient starting in 1993. So it's been importing oil for a very long time. Since 2013, it's been the world's largest importer of oil, and so it doesn't have sufficient resources domestically. And so it's been strategically developing resources around the world and importing to grow its domestic economy.
But more and more, maybe you could explain how China is trying to develop its sustainable energy program.
Right. China is one of the world's largest investors in renewable energy, for instance, but that doesn't really directly compete with oil, since that is primarily for power generation. China doesn't produce any power domestically from oil, or at least not a significant extent. China also is pushing aggressively into electric vehicles at the moment, so in the long run, we could see some changes there. China now has basically adopted the California zero emissions vehicle system, where you have certain quotas that car manufacturers need to meet in terms of sales of electric vehicles for their domestic fleet. And so China is trying very much to get away from fossil fuels, also because of its air pollution situation domestically. But none of these measures are likely to be able to offset the oil imports from Iran, at least not in this very, very short time frame.
That was VOA's Asia's Ira Melman speaking with Jonas Nam, Assistant Professor of Energy, Resources, and Environment at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies in Washington. While two of the key leaders of the Hong Kong's 2014 umbrella movement have been given prison sentences for their roles in the massive pro-democracy demonstrations, Benny Tai and Chan Kinmen were both sentenced to 16 months in prison yesterday, just over 2 weeks after they were convicted on conspiracy to commit public nuisance. Tai and Chan were two of the so-called Umbrella Nine, convicted earlier this month on various counts of public nuisance in connection with the umbrella movement that shut down key parts of the territory 5 years ago, demanding the direct election of Hong Kong's chief executive. Another member, lawmaker Tanya Chan, had her sentencing postponed because she is facing major surgery. This is VOA's International Edition.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has made headlines for pushing through unprecedented reforms. But many challenges lie ahead in creating a national consensus. Discussing Ethiopia's future on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. voanews.com.
Well, Mexico says 300,000 migrants have sought to reach the United States through its territory this year. U.S. President Donald Trump's administration has sent more than 1,000 asylum seekers, mostly from Central America, back to Mexico to wait the months or years it can take to process claims through an overloaded immigration system. Mexico says it will not accept any status that makes it a third-party nation for migrants seeking U.S. asylum. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador promised more humane treatment for Central American migrants when he took office in December. His left-leaning government issued thousands of year-long humanitarian visas in January, giving migrants legal access to jobs. But due to strong pressure from Washington, Mexico is backpedaling on those promises, leaving hundreds of migrants stranded in unsanitary camps near its southern border and allegations of irregular detentions. Well, Angola's Luanda province, home of the nation's capital, is surrounded by water. But clean water is not available for many of its residents. As Elizabeth Casimiro reports from Luanda, that while Angolan authorities work to improve access to potable water, delivery services, they are cashing in.
Luanda province is surrounded on three sides by water, the Bengo and Kwanza rivers and the Atlantic Ocean. But only half of its 8 million inhabitants have access to clean running water. Informal car washers like Herminio Shitembo have no choice but to use untreated sewage water to earn a living. He says they do this business because of hunger. They need to make ends meet. They are unemployed. That is why they're here. The United Nations Children's Agency says nationwide, 44% of Angolans still do not have access to clean water. UNICEF's deputy representative, Patricia Portela de Souza, says a lack of access to safe drinking water, sanitation, and hygiene are the main causes of infectious diseases.
It means that people are in danger because not having access to safe water equals the likelihood to get disease, increased morbidity, and many times mortality.
But the lack of clean water is also an opportunity for hundreds of drinking water delivery boys. They say people need this water because in the neighborhood where they sell it, there is no water whatsoever. There are taps, but they have never had running water. The public water company of Luanda, EPAL, admits there is a serious water shortage. EPAL spokesperson Vladimir Bernardo says Luanda's water company has an average production level of 540,000 cubic meters of water per day, while the daily need is over a million cubic meters. Luanda's water company says financial issues have slowed progress, but production projects in the works will eventually improve access to clean water. Meanwhile, Angolans do their best to get by, using what dirty water they have or the clean water they can sell. Elizabeth Casimiro for VOA News, Luanda.
Well, African leaders meeting in Cairo have offered Sudan's ruling military council 3 months to put democratic reforms in place. Protesters, however, continue their sit-in protest at the defense ministry, demanding that the transitional military council hand power over to a civilian government. In the streets of Khartoum, Sudanese still face the same problems that brought them into the streets in huge numbers. Also, Makila James, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for East Africa, has been in Khartoum and had what she called a very constructive meeting with Lieutenant General Abdel Fattah Abdurrahman Barhan, the head of the military council. James said they spoke about the need to see a civilian government in place. She said the U.S. wants to see a military government in place as soon as possible. My colleague Mario Ritter spoke with reporter Ruud Elmendorp, who is in Khartoum, about life in the Sudanese capital and the sentiment that lasting change might take place in the government and the country.
Ruud, how are you doing?
I'm quite fine. I'm standing in the middle of the old market area in the center of Khartoum. And as it looks like normal life is taking its course, but what we can see is still a kind of excitement on the streets. People are yelling here, they're whistling, there are small demonstrations. And if you talk to people, you can hear that they're quite excited that that the former president has been ousted and that a new Sudan may take form.
The demonstration started as protests against a hike in prices of staple foods. Have prices eased?
No, in fact, if you look at that, not so much has changed. That the prices are still high. People are complaining about that, that the changes are not coming really soon after a demonstration period of that started in December, and also the South Sudanese pound is still very low, so you can hear complaints here and there that normal life didn't really change.
Sudanese leader Omar al-Bashir has been removed, but the protesters are still near the defense ministry holding a sit-in, demanding that a civilian government replace the military group in power. What are people saying about the situation away from the protests?
They're more concerned about their daily lives, and what I can hear is a lot of happiness that at least there's a chance to a new beginning. But the problem is that this happened before twice in Sudan. In the 80s and the 60s, there have been similar revolts, but still the military came back after. But if you ask the people how they feel about it this time, they say no, this time we will not accept the military to come back. And it looks like they're willing to go very far for that, just to keep demonstrating until really the military gives the power back to the civilians.
Have you seen the military in the streets?
Yes, they're all over. They're guarding the situation, as they say. They say they're responsible for security, and they're taking that task seriously. You can see them everywhere around public buildings. They're also guarding the demonstration. And there are very interesting scenes of soldiers mingling with the demonstrators. I saw a soldier the day before yesterday who was having face painting with one of the demonstrators. So there's a kind of friendship between the soldiers and the demonstrators.
Ruud Elmendorp in Khartoum, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, too.
Well, the UN Refugee Agency calls a new training project in Cox's Bazar a potential game changer for local Bangladeshi and Rohingya refugee women who are learning potentially money-making skills. The UNHCR, which is supporting this project, has teamed up with a local NGO, the Aisha Abed Foundation. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The program aims to provide income opportunities to hundreds of impoverished women by teaching them skills in craft production. The project, which began in February, is now being scaled up. The UN Refugee Agency says the goal is to train 500 women by the end of the year. Half that number will comprise Rohingya refugee women, and the other half will be women chosen from among the Bangladesh communities hosting them. The UNHCR reports the women will receive a small stipend during the training period. If the project is successful, it says it hopes to expand it to include hundreds more women. The camps in Cox's Bazar hold more than 750,000 Rohingya refugees, most of whom fled to Bangladesh to escape violence and persecution in Myanmar in August 2017. UNHCR spokeswoman Liz Throssell agrees the number of women enrolled in the training project represents only a tiny fraction of the vast refugee population. But she tells VOA the worth of the project should not be based on numbers alone.
Small numbers, yes, but you have to start somewhere. It is providing income sources to these women. It is providing training. And as we've underscored, we are hoping that this will be expanded. So it is offering income sources both for the local community and for the refugees.
Throssell says the local and refugee women are being taught different skills. She says local Bangladeshi women are learning silkscreen, block printing, and tailoring techniques. The refugee women in the camps, she says, are being taught to produce a variety of hand-sewn embroidery pieces. She notes most of the Rohingya refugee women in the program are widows or single-mother households aged between 18 and 40. None, she says, have had any previous sewing experience. The items produced by the women will be sold in one of Bangladesh's best-known retail outlets. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, Rob McLean. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.